Hi, we here at the North American Christians in Social Work want to thank you for selecting this continuing education course. We appreciate your interest in pursuing ongoing trainings sensitive to the thoughtful integration of faith, social work practice, and spirituality. We hope that this training meets or exceeds your expectations and is useful to you. If you have any questions during or after the training, please don't hesitate to contact us at info@nacsw.org. Thanks again and enjoy the training.
All right. Well, thanks for coming. I know Saturday can be exhausting, right? Because we've been in so many things up until now. But yeah, as Katie mentioned, I spent last fall doing a sabbatical with World Relief. I had had international experience, worked overseas, started teaching 11 years ago, actually, and was interested in getting more experience working with international populations locally once I finished my doctorate and had a little more time maybe to do something. And one thing led to another to doing a sabbatical. There's a lot of refugee resettlement in Akron, Ohio, which is where I live. I work about a half an hour away in Canton from there. And so got connected with World Relief Akron, who was starting resettlement. There's another organization that's been doing immigration work for 100 years in the area and has a long history of refugee work. So there were already a lot of refugees in our area. And so I was talking to the director of World Relief Akron about what, you know, they'd be interested in for a sabbatical, and that led to this study. So she just, you know, said, you know, I'm really interested in trying to make sure we are not recreating refugee camps in Akron, Ohio, because there had been some people talking and wondering, like, what's happening? Are we doing this well? You know, are we empowering? She understood the community development model, CCDA, Christian Community Development Association model, and now they are actually a CCDA affiliate. And then part of my research has been related to anti-oppressive practice. So we kind of talked about all these things and the overlap, and we're trying to figure out how to do a study on using qualitative methodology to ask people working with refugees and, as we like to say, former refugees, people who have resettled, about their perspectives on refugee resettlement. And that led to this study, which has spent the last year working on it and still, you know, working on some, you know, new information and data from it. But this is sort of where we're at with what I've learned so far. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about understanding what is refugee resettlement. I think a lot of people hear a lot on the news, but don't fully understand who refugees are compared to general immigrants that come here. And then we'll talk a little bit about that, and then about our Christian faith values and how they intersect, and then think about the qualitative methodology that I used, and hopefully most of our time I'll actually be sharing the results of the study. But go through some introductory things first. So, what is a refugee? Does everybody know what a refugee is in here? Do you have an idea? Okay, so an official definition is a refugee is someone who has been forced to flee his or her country because of persecution, war, or violence. A refugee has a well-founded fear of persecution for reasons of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. Most likely, they cannot return home or are afraid to do so. War and ethnic, tribal, and religious violence are leading causes of refugees fleeing their countries. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Am I correct that economics is not a qualification of refugee status?
Correct, right. So we do sometimes use the term that people are coming as economic refugees, and there certainly are people that come here. But when we think about the actual legal term for refugees, so when we hear about people being resettled here as refugees, they have to come under this definition and come through an official policy, which I'm going to skip ahead just since you asked that question. This is, and you'll be able to see this better if you have the drive, the flash drive with the information. But there's an official resettlement process that happens here. So when we're talking about refugees, it's important to recognize we're not talking about people who've come here to flee, yeah, like you said, you know, economic issues, and they're very real. Some people are coming here for very real economic reasons, and there's obviously an overlap sometimes, you know, between the actual definition, but people have to go through a process, a vetting process to come here as refugees, and then they are helped in that resettlement process. It's usually a 90-day process. So this just, I'm not going to go through all the details of this, but they are resettled through the United Nations and then the Department of Homeland Security here, and then linked with a VOLAG, a voluntary agency, basically, which is that second column. And there's 9 of them in the United States, in lots of different cities. World Relief happens to be one of them. Majority of them are actually faith-based, although they're not all. And so they come here, are resettled through an agency, and then that agency works with them for a minimum of 90 days. Most of them have just 90-day funding. So in the first week, usually within the first 2 days, they're getting their social security number, they're getting an ID, getting set up and linked with job opportunities and all of that. They're given housing. They're even required to have a culturally appropriate meal when they arrive. So there's strict requirements to help people resettle. Doesn't mean the process is perfect, but there's a process there. But before they even get here, there's a very strict vetting process that takes place. And usually it's 6 months to 3 years. A lot of people you hear say have said 2 years. I've known people that have gone through it for 3 years that I talk to, especially from countries like the Middle East where people are more concerned about security issues. So, yeah, so that's the process. And there are, as it says on the right, there's some funding for longer support beyond that 90 days, but most of the people in our area only receive that 90 days of support. And then they can be eligible just like a typical U.S. citizen for social services that we would be eligible for, but not anything more or less than that. And then they can go through the process of becoming citizens. You know, they're being set up for that process, granted that Social Security card right away. All of that is happening for them in that process. They don't have to apply for that with any special, given refugee status gives them the status to get that Social Security card, because a lot of people kind of wonder about that. Some people are questioning, you know, are refugees undocumented? No, they're very documented, extremely documented, actually, in that whole process. Just to, you know, define and distinguish terms, I thought I'd start with that, because not everybody knows, and we hear this term being thrown around quite a bit, you know. So, all right, so really just thinking about what's been going on, right? We've been hearing about immigrants and refugees a lot lately, haven't we, in the news? And so just some background to this is just, and this might be obvious, but just to present, we're kind of in a place where we have a lot of people that are fearful. They're concerned. Who are these people that are entering our country? We have people questioning legal concerns, policy concerns, suggesting that we need a vetting process, which actually is in place. I'm not saying it doesn't need some work. We should always reevaluate how we're doing things, but we do have a vetting process that is pretty strict. People have economic concerns, you know, are these people taking away resources from people that are already in our country, things like that. And then just this idea of, are we offering a welcoming environment here? You know, many of us that do believe that we are to welcome people, are we? Or are we having, you know, or are we developing to more of an isolationist country? You know, we're going to, you know, close our borders and not welcome people as much. So, but then in doing research on refugee resettlement, as I've already said, there's a very rigorous vetting process, a long process for doing this. I mentioned the 90-day process already of how people get support when they first arrive. And then there are a lot of studies that have shown the economic benefit of resettlement. In the area I live in, Northeast Ohio, the Cleveland area and Akron both have had pretty detailed economic studies, not just on immigrants in general, but specifically refugees, and how much their investment is going back into the community. And in particularly places that have had a lot of displacement, the populations have gone down due to the economy, immigrants and refugees coming into those areas really have benefited the country. And an example, because one of the things that people are concerned about is how much money are we putting into this, right? Because of this 90 days of potential support, although once people are working, they're not getting that financial support. But because just like us, you know, the more money we make, the less that we can get of that. But for example, in 2013, about $2.8 million was put into refugee resettlement in Cleveland. It sounds like a lot, right? $2.8 million, that's a lot. But the study showed that the return on the investment with former refugees paying taxes, buying homes, starting businesses, because immigrants, including refugees, are almost twice as likely to start businesses than native-born people. So the return on the investment just in that 1 year was $28 million. So that's a pretty big return. And those people are typically staying, right? So every year that return continues. So that just gives you an idea that, you know, that some of these myths need to be debunked, you know. And then, you know, those of us who look at interpret scripture with thinking about immigration and refugee resettlement, there's a lot of evidence to show that as Christians, it's part of our calling to welcome immigrants, welcome refugees. For example, you know, in Leviticus 19:33, it says, "A stranger who resides among you, do him no harm. Treat them as one of your citizens. Love him as yourself." That's just, there's many scriptures. I'm just going to throw out a couple. Matthew 25:35, we're familiar with that passage about, you know, to welcome, as we welcome strangers, we're welcoming Jesus. Just as examples, I'm thinking about Jesus and his family, they were political refugees. They had to leave, you know, they left the area to save Jesus's life, you know, because of a policy, right? That was putting people's lives in danger that were the age of Jesus, right? Because of Herod being threatened, you know. So there's, you know, scriptural evidence, you know, for welcoming foreigners, loving them as ourself, loving our neighbor as ourself, right? So there's all that, there's this evidence, but there's clearly been conflicts, right, within the church. And I've definitely had some experiences where I've had people that were just really, really angry that I was in support of refugee resettlement because of their legitimate fear, genuine fear that they were concerned that people were going to hurt us here. And so just as I introduced this study, I just wanted to share some of that, some of the basics of, like, this is kind of where we've been at, you know, in our society. And there's some legitimate concerns, but there's a lot of evidence that goes against those concerns. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I completely agree with everything that you're saying. Mm-hmm. Play the devil's advocate.
Sure.
Are mm-hmm. you aware of any numbers of refugees through who have come in through this rigorous vetting program who have then gone on to commit terroristic acts?
No. And there's, you know, we definitely have had people commit terrorist acts. So there's a concern, right, that there's people that are, you know, coming from other places or being trained in the Middle East. But typically they're coming through other ways, you know, through a marriage visa or a student visa or other experiences, but not through that refugee resettlement process.
I'm going to make the hypothesis that the ones that I see, Boston bombers, etc., mm-hmm. are children of second generation
right.
that, immigrants yep. and refugees, mm-hmm. and the failure to integrate and to be mm-hmm. properly welcome may be the biggest risk factor.
Could be. Boston. Yeah, that's a good observation.
At all, just a,
yeah.
a hypothesis.
Yeah, yeah. That's fair enough. Yeah, so, yes, go ahead.
I'm like 99.9% certain that none of them have been children of refugees. There's been zero terrorists.
Yeah, but children of immigrants, right?
The Boston bombers, I think, were children of asylees, which...
Yeah, and that's a good point. So, you know, asylees are, and that's a definition we didn't talk about, but they are people that come here and get here through, sometimes it's tourist visa, sometimes it's, you know, through various reasons, but then they meet the definition of refugee status and receive it once they're here.
Right.
So that's another, serious. Right, yeah. And so they're already here, and then they meet that definition, typically because they're from one of the countries that if they would have applied over there, they would have been granted that status as well. So that's another one of those terms that sometimes we don't fully understand what that means. So any other questions, comments as we continue? All right, thanks for sharing your thoughts. All right, so we went through that. So now we're going to talk about the research study itself. Okay, so I did qualitative interviews. They were approximately 1 hour. I had 26 participants, but 20 interviews. So some of them, sometimes I interviewed two people together. And if they were together, there were people that worked together in refugee resettlement, or they were people that were from the same country and came as refugees and knew each other. I didn't put random people together. It was like, for example, two business owners that are partners in the area, and I interview them together, you know. And that was interesting because they knew each other, you know, much longer than I had known them, and played off each other and support. Sometimes they were family members as well. So 19 of the people I interviewed were working in refugee resettlement. 13 of the people were born outside of the United States, so came as immigrants of some sort. 9 specifically had come as refugees. So it was about 50-50 immigrants versus people non-immigrants. Some of those immigrants or former refugees were working in resettlement themselves. Some were not. So tried to get a variety of perspectives. And when I share quotes, you'll see that many of the quotes, you'll know the situation of them by their quotes, really. Okay, so transcribed, coded for themes. I used Atlas TI software, which is a qualitative program that, thanks to Malone, I have access to. So if you don't have that through a university, it's a very expensive program, so I'm very thankful for that. And then analyze the results based on what they said. So I always make that clear, especially if I'm not talking to researchers, like, these quotes, these results are the participants' perspectives, not based on my opinion, not based on, you know, just general conversations, but what people actually said in the research. Yeah.
Do you know what nation are most of these people?
Oh, yeah, I don't have that on here just because of the time. But, yeah, so many of them, that's a good question, were from, in our area, we have a lot of Nepali Bhutanese people. So I had many from there. I had 3 that were from the Middle East, different countries, Syria and Iraq, were actually the 2 countries they were from. 1 from Vietnam, so he had been here longer, and so had, you know, like 20 years to talk about, you know, his process. I'm trying to think. Those were the main areas that they were from. And then the immigrants I interviewed were all actually from Asia or Southeast Asia. So, I was trying to get people from more variety of places, but you have to find people that are open and willing. I was trying to get some Congolese people, but it was hard because I was trying to be really sensitive to how long they had been here. And some of the former refugees get asked to do so much when they have those charismatic personalities. And I was meeting some people and asking and just sensing, yeah, maybe this just isn't right. So trying to be an ethical social worker and in that whole process of, you know, not imposing myself too much on people, even though I was trying to get as much diversity as possible. Yeah. All right. So I asked a variety of questions. One of the questions I asked was, what does it look like for a refugee to be empowered? So these were the most common things. And this is everyone together, aggregate data at this point. I haven't actually separated it yet. So this is people that are working day in and day out in resettlement, some as paid workers, some as very, very dedicated volunteers. Like, one of the guys is a retired assistant provost from a state university who spends all his time working with refugees in his retirement. You know, so there's some people like that, and as well as people that are working within refugee resettlement agencies or organizations that work in general immigration, just in, like, nonprofits that work with immigrants of all kinds, but asking them specifically about refugees. So the first one was language skills. That's pretty obvious, right? This is what people were saying. So language skills and financial security were at the top. And the next one was civic engagement and leadership. So those are the things people were saying. You know, we think that these are important for people to feel empowered. Then the next one, and this did come up quite a bit, was helping other refugees. So it's not just about basic needs, according to people working with refugees and refugees themselves. They want to be independent, as the next one says, but they also want to be able to give back. But then there was other practical things, like, you don't have to know everything. I don't know how to do everything in my community, but helping to know how to navigate the system. So having people that can help them figure that out, knowing how to ask the right questions. And having education was another one. And having relationships within and outside the community. And that was interesting because I had done research on the impact of semester abroad students, social work students, and how that has affected them when they came back. And the same outcome came out of that, this importance of having relationships within the local culture to help you navigate the system. And then some people from your own culture that you can vent to, that you can eat your own food with, they know what you're talking about. But it's really important, and a lot of former refugees said it, that if we just stay with people from our own culture, and that was that recreating the refugee camp idea, then we're not benefiting from the relationships of people who live here. We're not knowing how to navigate the systems. We're not knowing how to start a business and know what to sign, what not to sign for loans, and people getting themselves in bad deals, you know, things like that. So those relationships were important. So have that oasis, you know, of people like you that you can talk with, you know, two of these guys had opened a Nepali restaurant in the area. And, you know, it's just, you know, wonderful that they have that for their own community and for us to enjoy their culture. But they were like, we can't just stay here. We have to step out. And this was very consistent, you know, amongst people working with refugees as well as refugees themselves. You have to be in both worlds. That integration is extremely important, you know, not to become all American, right? Not to lose your culture, but also to have people that you can help interpret the culture for you and advocate for you and help you get a job in your field when you're shredding paper, but you're, you know, an amazing businessman, you know, with all this experience. You just don't know the language yet, so it's hard to get through there, you know, get to that process. You're going to see some repetition in what I'm sharing, but then I asked, What is the number one sign of empowerment? Like, if you could just say, actually ask the top three. What are the top three signs? Like, so prioritize, you know. And these were the things that came up. The top four number one things that people said were career advancement, adequate income, community leadership, helping others. So that was really important. We just don't want to help our family, but we want to help others. And I have quotes about some of these. I'll show you in a little bit. Local language skills and transportation. Transportation is such a big thing because people don't usually come with vehicles. I did notice the people from the Middle East did seem to have more resources, more savings they brought with them, and could within 3 to 6 months maybe get a car. But people that, like Nepali people, for example, they had the average time they've spent in a refugee camp was 18 years, and they weren't legally allowed to work in their country. And so they didn't come with resources, you know. So the public transportation systems, a lot of bus trainings, things like that, helping people to good-hearted volunteers that want to drive people everywhere to do more than just drive them, but help them to learn how to ride the bus and get places themselves so they're not just dependent on others, but figuring that out, helping them save for a car, figure out how to do that, things like that was really, really important as it related to transportation. And then when, you know, the question I asked, what are your top three signs of refugee empowerment? This was the overall list. So when you looked at the top three, adequate income and career advancement rose to the top in that situation. And that was a big thing, this idea that there's so many people that within Akron, most people have a job within 30 days, but they're typically minimum wage jobs and not necessarily in the field they were in before. And then, like, one person just talked about how they feel stuck because they have a large family. Most of the people I interviewed are from cultures where the woman stays home if they are a family. So the man is a primary breadwinner. They might be making $12,000 a year having a family of six. I mean, this was a very common thing. It's amazing strength. A lot of these people are still somehow trying to figure out how to buy a house, and they do it because families get together and save the money and then they buy a house for cash and they all live in it together, you know. So there's a lot of strengths there. But when you think about, like, what do we need, not just a job, but adequate income and ability to advance in a career of some sort. Native language skills keeps popping up. That's another one that is obviously very important. Community leadership, helping others again, and transportation again. And then there's a few other things that relate to what we were already talking about. But a big thing was refugees want career advancement in a way that helps others and society. It wasn't just about them. And that's something, you know, culturally, a lot of the countries that people are coming from are very community oriented. I mean, one thing about our culture that we don't always recognize compared to other countries is how independent we are. Not that we don't help our families in any way, but there was a great emphasis on this, that many people, when they talked about what empowerment looked like, it wasn't just for themselves or their children. It was for their extended family, you know, to be able to help. If one person could have that adequate income, maybe not everybody, but then that would help the whole family or that career advancement. And it wasn't just the way we say, oh, we can make a better life for our children. That was there, but it wasn't just that. It was greater than that. And that really, that idea, but then also helping others, helping society. People want to give back. They want to be involved in civic engagement in some way or another beyond the community. And I think that's really important for us to recognize. And the value, especially in communities like Akron that have a growing international population. So now I'm going to share some quotes here. Let's see where we are with time. Okay. So this is someone I called Raif, and he is acting, when I interviewed him, he was acting as an interpreter. And he's from the Middle East, and he had been a teacher and a business owner in the country he came from, and he does want to start a business someday. And so he had had a really interesting story where he actually had not had a great experience with his refugee resettlement process in another city, and then ended up, he had friends in Akron, and then got, during that 90 days, he got resettled in Akron through World Relief Akron, and now he was actually doing interpretation for them and another agency in the area. But he said, as it related to empowerment, you know, some people have certificate or have bachelor degrees, but here in the United States, they should evaluate this certificate until they can get a job for the people that have degrees. I've heard some stories, a lot of refugees were suffering when they came here to the United States because the first thing they do, the caseworker or the organization or the agencies do for you to find a job after a month. So the job is just to be a laborer. I know some guys who are engineers, some who are physicians, they started working in different atmospheres and they still will wait there. I'm in this process. It takes time. He recognized it takes time, but some people just get stuck. I think a lot of us are aware of this phenomena, but it was very real to them. Like, we're not using our skills here. And some of them have the language skills. Some of them don't, but sometimes it's that recognition. And I know there's some funding out there. It came up through our Center for Cross-Cultural Engagement at Malone for universities to do to work with immigrants and refugees to have their some certificates or have their training be recognized here. It's not easy. It's different for every. Imagine if people were social workers and what that would be like, right? To get that, you know. But you know, engineers, it's the same sort of thing. You know, it's if it's a skill based job, it's one thing. Like, for example, my husband has been involved in helping people start businesses in the area and is a big fan for the economic reasons. He thinks, you know, he's an engineer, so he thinks very black and white. And he's like, you know, it just makes perfect sense economically for immigrants to be here. So we need to help them be empowered. And so the business side is important to him and he's got the skills. And so we had this one guy that just said, I want to start a construction business here. Didn't have the language. And he didn't, as we met with him, and he had no idea how to use our tools, how to use our drywall. But if somebody can give him a job and he can learn how to do those things, hopefully someday he can start a business because we know the data is there that immigrants and refugees are very likely to start a business, but somebody needs to give him that chance so that he can develop those skills here and do that, just as an example. So we were linking him with someone that could help him to do some jobs. And, you know, when somebody's like, what do you want to get paid? He didn't even know, you know, what he should get paid, you know, but helping with mentoring partnerships is important in that process. So Nazir, he's another Middle Eastern guy. Through an interpreter, he explained his passion is to give my experience to other people and to get money from this. But money is not my goal. Money is just a way to live. But my passion is to, of course, to practice my job and to get other people to learn about these things, this craft, to teach other people. He was showing me pictures of the furniture he used to make in Syria. And then he, on his way over, he was in Turkey for a while. And he started a business in Turkey. And his son still lives there and can import. And it was amazing. Like, he, exquisite furniture that may not necessarily be exactly what Americans always want, right? Because it's a little bit of a different style. It was like museum quality looking furniture. But he can translate those skills if somebody is willing to support him to learn that. And he's got a large family, is shredding paper, you know, and really, really brilliant man. Needs the language skills, but it was I was with them for 3 hours. as they kept serving me coffee and tea with their amazing Middle Eastern hospitality, till like 10 o'clock at night. So that was a long interview, but because of the interpretation and everything, I didn't really count it as a 3-hour interview. So, and so these two guys are from Nepal, and they have started several businesses in the Akron area. And they said, our goals are to expand business, being free to make more money than the money we're spending, make other people like us strong, help others. This is the main goal, because we never forgot where we came from. We just want to show all people how to work, how to be successful. If we get started, we'll show them, we'll lead them with our community, all the people we know. And I've seen them already do this. I mean, they're a part of the Bhutanese Community Association in Akron, which they did have. Somebody helped them start, an American helped them start just because of the language ability. But they, they're carrying it on with many other people. They're super involved in the community, and they're just emphasizing how much they want to give back. But admitting the areas, other quotes I have from them, and they just realize they needed help. They want help because they have gotten themselves in some challenging business deals because of not knowing what they were signing. And this didn't come out directly in here, but one thing I've just noticed through this year and a half of working with former refugees is they trust us so much. Mm-hmm. So that idea that, we have to help them navigate who to trust and not trust, because they just think, oh, he can trust us. He's a good guy. He's a good guy. And then you look at the lease and you're like, you're responsible for every single repair in this building that's falling apart. And they couldn't keep one of their businesses open, because of that. People aren't going to come into a business that has no air conditioning or heat and there's holes in the ceiling, And so anyway, all right. So another thing is barriers to empowerment, right? So there's things that get in the way. So what are the perceptions on those barriers? So transportation, that had come up before, right? That is something. Mental health was a big one. There have, unfortunately, been a number of suicides of refugees in our area. And one of the stories that's going around, even though I don't know if it's completely accurate, is a guy that just got lost in the community and didn't know how to get home on the bus and then jumped off a bridge the next day. That integration, that assimilation, that process of learning the culture, getting around, was really scary. And he was someone that had grown up in a refugee camp, so Akron is huge to him, so that has been a concern in our community. So mental health professionals, and I look at this in terms of empowerment, we need mental health professionals trained that are from those cultures, because right now a lot of it's happening through interpreters, which things are going to get lost in that process, even though it's better than not having it at all, right? The anti-refugee sentiment was number three. So think about the fact that there's a lot of anti-refugee sentiment. It's not just like, and it's actually, people are perceiving it as a barrier, not just as, oh yeah, there's people that don't like us, but they're seeing it as a barrier towards empowerment. This fear, this concern about the economics of immigrants coming here, all of that has become a barrier. Lack of independence, right? So that's the opposite of self-sufficiency. So people that become dependent, such as, this is why our training for volunteers, it's so important that it's not just about taking you places. Yeah, for the first week, let people settle, let people have rides, but finding ways that people can know how to get places on their own. Right, as social workers, this makes sense to us, right? But we have a lot of good-hearted people that are really caring, but then people don't know how to do anything on their own, right? So helping people very, very deliberately be empowered. And I was able to present this research to the World Relief executive team because they came through Akron, and now they want me to present it to all of their directors so they can really work on a model. Like, how can we implement this into our training of volunteers? Because I was watching it happen. Like, this guy, he's like, I don't know what to do. I took him to an appointment. I don't know how to get here again. So I show him my phone, show him the walking directions. Like, we are a mile from this doctor's office. So showing him how to get there. But I was watching other volunteers not do that, just taking them. But he can learn how to get somewhere in a mile. Very able-bodied person. Not everybody is in that situation, but I knew he could learn it. But someone has to help him learn it. Like, it takes longer. Walk him there, right? It takes longer, but then you don't have to keep doing it. Cultural isolation was another one, or a cultural adjustment, excuse me, was the next one, and then isolation. So those sort of somewhat go together, because if people are isolated, they're not adjusting to the culture. Education not being recognized. And then this next one, even though it's lower down, it was still a very common theme: faith communities' methods of helping. So I'm going to spend some time talking about that, because to me that was a hard one, and one that I think we need to learn from. So that's what we'll spend some time talking about. The time frame of resettlement, 90 days. Can you imagine? You went to a country with nothing and with trauma on top of that, and you had to be empowered within 90 days to know how to do everything yourself. I mean, it's not very long. Yeah, and I, you know, spent time living overseas and, you know, and was an American that was privileged, you know, and I helped lots of students adjust through that process, and people still need help, and they're not, and we weren't even working Romanian jobs, you know, we were working with, like, I was a missionary raising my support, you know, and imagine, like, if you had to learn the system in that much detail, it's challenging for sure. All right, so what does oppression look like? So lack of community education. So this has come up again. Lack of community education on refugee resettlement. A hostile, unwelcoming environment. Refugees not treated with dignity and worth. Systemic oppression and faith communities' methods of practice equaling a bad witness. Those were things that came up when it was like, what actually is oppression feeling like? And I had to explain what oppression was to a few people. Most people knew, but, you know, and there was one person that did not, well, everyone had something except one guy that he was like, I can't even identify any oppression because there was so much oppression where I came from. Because he was realizing this is a free country. And most people were really thankful for the freedom they had in the U.S. But I was trying to get at, what are those things that are like barriers to oppression, to empowerment, but specifically are, you know, the feelings of oppression, and that's what came up. All right, so a man named that I call Andrew, who is the director of a nonprofit working with immigrants, not specifically refugees, but they do work with a lot of refugees. So they're not a refugee resettlement agency, so they can work with people as long as it makes sense, you know. And talking about the need to learn best practice methods to empower, because I was asking, like, what do you think are best practice methods? How should we work towards empowerment? He said, this is tricky because there's this intersection of ministry and calling and faith. And actually, I didn't know whether or not he was a person of faith or not. And this is what he said, because I wasn't focusing on faith in my research. It's just, this is what people said. All right, so I'll start over. Okay. So he said, this is tricky because there's this intersection of ministry and calling and faith, and there's this intersection of help, but being clear that help is not enabling, but it's empowering help. That needs to be wrestled with, and I suspect that faith-based organizations, churches, have good intentions. They want to do this work, but I sometimes am not sure if they're fully aware how to do the work. And the second thing that I would say is that too often we've had instances where churches are like, oh, we want to help refugees, we want to help them, or things like they welcome us in, and then as time goes by, you hear things like, you know, they're not flushing the toilet, or they're throwing garbage in the hallway, or giving volunteers free space to do the work. The reality of working with refugees, I just don't think they're comprehending cultural competency issues, things like that, and they're complaining quickly about things. They just have to be prepared. I also think if they were less prescriptive with their funding. So, and after this study was over, it was a classic example, church that has done so much in the area to equip volunteers to work in resettlement. So they've done a lot of good, wonderful stuff. But they decided to do this big fundraising project for refugee resettlement, have that be a theme. So it's a church that's really saying, we want to help immigrants and refugees. And they decided on, they didn't ask World Relief. What they did is they decided to do welcome packages. And this was during the time they didn't really know if they'd have more refugees coming. And so they put together these welcome packages. And Kara, thankfully, the director of World Relief, she in Akron, she can say it like it is directly. And she's just like, really appreciate these. In the long run, we will use these. but we really wish you would have asked, because what we really need is a van, because we have a lot of large families coming, because more people were coming from the Middle East, and traditionally many of them had large families, and we need a van so we can pick people up together in a van, take people together to the medical appointments and the Social Security appointments, because they were literally like borrowing random vans from people. And now we have to pay for storage for these welcome packages. And the church felt, I think people felt bad then, and they said, we're going to pay for the storage. But it wasn't what the need was, you know. And a welcome package is an easier thing to slowly get, not a big van. But the amount of money they raised would have been enough for a van, you know. And so, and these are people that actually want to help immigrants and refugees, and they're doing a lot within their church to advocate, which is great. But there's still some missing pieces here, you know, things that aren't happening quite as we'd think. And here's some guys that are Buddhist that we're sharing about. And the question I was asking is, what can faith communities do? Are there things they can do to help support? As well as I asked about government organizations and what the refugee resettlement agency. So I was asking, what can people do in the community? What can just general community members do? But they held on to the faith community question and asked this question. They said, they, referring to refugees, they don't know anything here, you know. So some people, they are taking advantage of them, and they are forcing them to change their religion and making them Christian, forcing them to go to church, like they are giving some housing stuff, and instead of that, they want them to come to church and have them in church every week, once a week, something like that I've heard about. Because of that, many families, they're frustrated. Some people, they broke their family because of this. Some would be wanting this help. Others would not be wanting. Some people come here, they join the community, like they give them wrong information to involve them, and that affects their family. And this quote was just so hard for me to hear. It's like, but we need to hear it, because it's like their perception is that Christians are breaking apart families. Some are converting to Christianity, some are not, and it's, you know, affecting the family. And there's a manipulation that he's expressing going on here as well. So those were things that I think we as believers and as social workers need to hear, right? You know, we need to hear that this is how things are being perceived by the refugee community. And we know that this happens in a variety of communities and people in need, not just within refugee communities. But when you have the cultural barriers, you know, and all that, and as the way they're interpreting things might be, it might make it come across even more extreme, more potential to feel manipulation. Just for the sake of time, I'm probably not going to read these full quotes, but Kim from Vietnam, he expressed something similar, and he was talking a bit about the cultural competency issues, that there are a lot of people that are supplementing their income by going places to receive food packages and things like that. And he was concerned that people are just giving people food packages and not recognizing religious differences with the food they're getting. So, and they don't always know what the label means. And they get home, they're like, oh, this is beef, this is pork, we can't eat it. And then it gets thrown away, you know. And if they're either vegetarian or they're not eating pork, you know, for example, it's wasted food that could be given to someone else. So now to what can we do? What are strategies to empower? So based on their perspective, these are things that people I talked to said were strategies towards empowerment. So the big one was relationship building. Several people said, just smile, just be friendly. This was referring to just average, everyday community members. People are feeling that fear, feeling that concern, feeling unwelcome. So just simply encouraging people to be friendly, to smile, to get to know the person with whatever amount of language they have or limited language, you can still smile. You can still help them practice their English with just a few basic things. So it starts with a smile, but goes much deeper. And there were examples that were definitely much deeper than that. Equipping the faith community. And as we see from these quotes, it's not just about, oh, help refugees, but that training, that true equipping them with knowledge, values, skills, to help in a way that's not oppressing further. educating refugees, so helping them with that cultural adjustment process, helping them to know how to navigate what's a scam, what's real, all those sorts of things, and teaching independence I put under that as well. And so that was a big thing with the longer term relationships that develop beyond that 90 days. And a lot of places are doing a great job of this. And this is happening a lot in Akron, but they need more people, you know, to have people linked with mentors, friends. And if this is done right, there's a lot of mutual learning that takes place. And just helping people to navigate, you know, systems. And one guy I talked to who has volunteered a lot with refugee resettlement, another retired man, he just said, he was giving very specific examples, like helping people, you know, to figure out how to pay bills and sitting there with them with their mail, just going through mail together to know what's real, what's not real, and all of that. Educating the American-born community, which, you know, with all these things, the myths versus the truth, culturally appropriate anti-oppressive ways of helping people, and then helping people to use their skills, education. And Alexa, who's an American-born person who is a friend of many refugees and a ministry leader for refugee resettlement out of her church, she said, both having an equal hand and a role in the process. So I think some of it comes from how I see people. I think we're now getting to the place and we're not there yet. But as we're planning something, it's just people from my church planning it. Or do I get some of my friends and have them plan it? And her friends, she means, are former refugees. You know, how can we help them to, you know, plan their own activities, be empowered? Sounds obvious to us as social workers when we think about our basic principles of social work, but it's not always happening. And so she continues to go on about that. And then she says, I've heard them say over and over again, about independence. I want to be independent. But it's really funny because people would want to go and buy them a new TV, but they say, I don't want you to buy me a TV. I want you to teach me how to drive, because that means I'm independent. So people helping people to learn how to drive, especially from countries where they had lived in a refugee camp a long time. So that's where more of the Nepali people in our community, for example, and people from Burma, Burmese people as well. You know, those are two groups where they usually don't have the driving skills. Middle East, it's different, and I think they're more quickly getting empowered. I did notice that the Middle Eastern people I interviewed said, we're not like them. We don't like to be called refugees because we're not like those other refugees, because they hadn't lived in a camp, you know, even though they came with refugee status, but there definitely was some sort of division between people. So examples of refugee empowerment. Listening's so important. Listening to the desires of refugees and letting them lead with these desires. So finding out, just like the study did, trying to listen. How can we listen to their needs, their desires, not just say, we think you need this, but, you know, what do you need? You know, how can we help you get there? Local professionals working with refugees with similar skills and interests. So, for example, businessmen or people that, you know, that work in particular trades and can help people be able to use their skill and develop their skills here. Finding ways for people's education to be recognized or to be able to access that education. I really appreciated that at Malone, where I teach, our president about a year ago had asked the VP of enrollment if there were ways that we could help immigrants, undocumented immigrants, and refugees enroll at Malone. And then he had a conversation with me because I had just come back from the sabbatical. The VP talked to me about it, and he didn't understand the definition of refugee. So it was starting with that and just letting him know that people who come here as refugees are eligible for the same financial aid as any other American citizen, which isn't necessarily the case for undocumented people, even though we've had some undocumented students, but they've usually come with athletic scholarships. And so that, you know, just he, that like opened it up. He's like, this, oh, wow, you know, this is great. You know, we don't have to figure out, I mean, there's some creative things they would still need to do. So then we had conversations with people that are working with refugees, as well as one former refugee himself, about like, how can we facilitate this? We haven't really gotten very far with it, but at least it's in process. Ethnic organizations and churches, encouraging, empowering that to happen. There are a lot. There's I don't know, at least 11 Nepali churches in our community. You know, so it's happening. But this is another thing that there's some areas where there's more of a need to encourage people to develop their own organizations. And we as Americans, how many of us like to eat ethnic food and go to, you know, so there's a mutual learning. And when they do festivals and things, which they do a lot in Akron, that comes from that. Former refugees serving their own communities as leaders and professionals. So it's, they actually, World Relief has shared some stories about how it is, they find it hard, to be honest, to hire former refugees to work in case management because they're still figuring out the system, but they realize it's worth that hard effort because, especially in, you know, countries that people are coming from that are, they're continuing to come and be resettled, that have the cultural competency and all that. So being very, very deliberate to try to hire people from those communities, those cultures that speak the language, to work with people as they come. And it's a form of empowerment. And
we,
then,
we found
yeah.
that hiring mm-hmm. them to be language interpreters
yeah.
for new families coming in
yes.
is just such a win-win.
Right, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Together into an established community. So
yeah, definitely. So starting as interpreters, right, because that doesn't require more skill than the language, right? But then, so you don't need an interpreter, can you have a case manager, you know, and going levels like that. But you're still going to need interpreters because you're not going to probably have case managers from every community, every culture, yeah. And even medical professionals. And there is an, Asia Inc. is one of the organizations in our community that is working with immigrants, and they actually have a clinic now that is catered towards immigrants, and many of them, actually most of them, are refugees, and they have people from the dominant refugee groups that work there that speak the languages, so that's really helpful as well. Churches providing empowering services, so there's a few resources that are great for churches, Toxic Charity, When Helping Hurts. These are not academic books, but are resources that we can bring to our churches to help people think critically through how are we helping. They're not specific with immigration work, but they translate well into this kind of work to help people think about how are we working with people in a way that is going to be empowering and not oppressive. Business startup funds, educational scholarships, pathways to vehicle and home ownership. There are some savings programs. Somebody presented on it here, the individual development accounts, for example, and things like that, that there are organizations tapping into these to help people have, like, matching grants for if you save this amount of money for certain things like a home, a vehicle, or education, then that can be matched. So it doubles their money, for example, which can really help. Learning about credit, one of the guys I've gotten to know, Asia Inc. was helping him to establish understanding, they were paying off their credit card bills really fast, like in 4 months, but not paying it for the 4 months prior, you know, and not realizing that had damaged their credit, even though that credit card bill had been paid off. And that personal credit card from like a local store was affecting their ability to get business loans, you know, so that education, you know, is important, as education is important in that process. So this is the last slide. And just thinking about like this, bringing it all together, how do we offer anti-oppressive refugee resettlement work? So I think there's this a balance between educating and equipping the church, for example, when we're thinking about how can we as Christians help equip the church and understanding and having that knowledge, the values and the skills to do this in an empowering, anti-oppressive way, looking at the myths versus the facts, empowerment versus dependency, that value of the long-term relationship. Sometimes we, as Americans, are so into this quick transactional relationship. You know, do it, get it done. Oh, good, I got them to their appointment. I got them back. Perfect, I did my job. But how do we do it in a way that helps that person feel valued, empowered, you know, that whole thing in that process, if that's the need we are asked to meet. And really to helping people, like what's happening at your church, Rick, to build those long-term relationships with people is so important beyond that 90 days. Developing cultural competency and cultural humility, right? Thinking about how can we learn from each other? It's a mutual relationship, mutual giving and learning. The data shows that immigrants and refugees are an asset to our community. How do we tap into that? And we need to learn. And then the other side, helping refugees develop those relationships where they have that mix, that balance between being in their culture, having their own food, being able to vent, speak their language, and then stepping out of that to navigate and learn and integrate into the culture. And that did come up a lot, you know, people saying we need those relationships. And some of them even gave me like percentages. Like I, you know, one former refugee said, I think it should be 50-50, 50% native-born American friends, 50% people from my culture and my community, my family. Someone else said 30-70, like 70% American. It was funny. I wasn't asking for this, but they had their ideas. Like, but the point is they, you know, they need relationships within both communities, for example. How can we facilitate leadership? How can we provide mental health support is really important with us as helping professionals, many of us clinical social workers. How can we support that practical cultural adjustment, that skill recognition and skill building? I've said all of this before, but just fostering this leadership and all of that. Just these are things that as we are helping equip people to serve refugees, they're all important. So it's not just about that refugee having what they need to be empowered, but it's about what are we doing to help people be informed and educated in a way that understands the value and the asset that immigrants and refugees have in our community.
We hope that you enjoyed this training. Please remember to take the post-test and the course evaluation in order to receive your CEU certificate. If you have any additional input or questions, please don't hesitate to contact us at the information you can find on our main webpage or email us at info@nacsw.org. We hope that you will consider taking additional courses on topics sensitive to the thoughtful integration of faith, spirituality, and social work practices through our program. Thanks again, and thanks for supporting NACSW.